This podcast is sponsored by Kinexys Recruit, Ireland's leading digital recruitment agency. Whether you're looking to reach top talents, considering a career switch, or in need of guidance on the ever-changing talent landscape, partnering with Kinexys is a no-brainer.
Welcome to Season 2 of the Interview Expert Podcast. I'm your host, Owen Murray, the CEO of YourHire.ie, job interview preparation for everyone, including anyone with ADHD or anxiety. I'm honored to have sat down with Brent Pope to kick off season two. Brent was part of the All Black training squad leading into the 1987 World Cup, but was sadly injured in the last game before the tournament started. That All Blacks team ended up winning the World Cup and is often talked about as one of the strongest rugby teams ever to play. He is also a high-profile media personality, clothing brand owner, award-winning author, art gallery curator, and charity worker. Not only that, but he is one of Ireland's leading mental health advocates. The focus of today's episode is all about taking care of your mental health, especially while looking for a job. This is a conversation to remember and one I will never forget. Brent, welcome to the pod. Brent, if someone was just clicked onto this podcast to listen because the thumbnail was interesting or that the title was interesting, with the understanding that we are going to talk about mental health during an interview process and the work that you do with setting up Elephant in the Room, can you tell me exactly why they should stay and listen to this conversation?
I don't want to be saying that because I'd probably be detrimental myself. I'd be saying, get off now. No, I think seriously, Owen, because I probably, in rap terms, I'm an OG. I'm an old gangster in the sense that I've been going around since for about the last 15 or 16 years, maybe 20 years, I can't remember. I've been going around the country trying to advocate to people to just look after their mental health and others' mental health a bit better, you know. And I've seen over the years people say to me, oh, things are changing and people are talking about it more. But I go back to the stats and I say we're still, you know, far too many people are still taking their own lives each year in Ireland and around the world. Far too many people are getting themselves in a situation where they're angst-driven or depressed or lonely, all these things. Loneliness has become a killer in this country, as it is in another country for people in rural Ireland or rural New Zealand. So I'm just about why people should listen, because I've had a life of experience. Sometimes when I go out and I listen to people talk about mental health from a book, per se, I feel like standing up sort of and yelling out, how would you know if you haven't been there? How would you know? Mm-hmm. It's okay for people to say, okay, I know what that feels like. But unless they've been there, they actually don't know what it feels like. And it's not a simple matter of saying one shoe fits everybody. You know, it doesn't. So you've got to come at it from different ways. If you're struggling with anxiety or depression, we'll talk a bit about whether it's related to an interview or whether it's related to a driving license or a first date, whatever it is, there's things that you can do to calm yourself down. Because here's the question I ask people when I'm out there talking. I say, put up your hand if you've done something specific for your physical health over the last week or the last month, for instance, gone for a walk by the sea, played a bit of tennis, gone to the gym, whatever. Most people put their hands up in the room, right? You know, that's understandable. Most people will. Most people know about diet and nutrition and water and sleep and all these things. I'll ask the same question and say, but have you done anything specifically for your mental health? Only two or three people in the room will put up their hand. And they look at me and they say, what do you mean? I'm saying things like mindfulness, meditation, all these things, because the thing for me is my background dictates that I knew all about my physical health. I knew all about it. I was a fit rugby player, working out in the gym every day, looked after my diet, looked after my hydration, looked after all these things, but it still didn't help. Well, it helped to a certain degree, but I couldn't tie the thread between being physically well and mentally unwell. Because mental health, when we say mental health, it suddenly sometimes seems to morph out into a bad thing. But mental health can be positive as well as it can be negative. Mental illness is a bit different because it's an illness, and an illness will always be negative. And people always say to me, oh, mental health, mental illness, the same. No, it's not the same. Mental health is something that you know, as I said, can be just as simple as giving yourself more confidence or planning your way through anxiety. Mental illness is a bit different. Mental illness, if you're suffering from mental illness, then you clearly need help. But so if people want to stay on and listen to a few, I suppose, wisdom ideas from a life lived with mental health and also gone back and studied as a qualified psychotherapist for my own journey. So there's a bit of science involved and but more so to experience of what I've learned. You know, I've talked to people all over the world, experts on mental health for my own journey. So I pick up little nuggets every person I talk to and say, oh yeah, I didn't look at it that way. I jot them down and I go back and say, okay, if I'm feeling if I'm in a funk or I'm in a low mood or I'm anxious or something, I go to work. That's the difference.
So is a fit body a fit mind?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. Because if that was the case, we wouldn't have any athletes or people that are in peak physical condition complaining about mental health issues.
Yeah.
And in fact, for a lot of sports, professional sports now, it's a really dangerous area. You can talk about these young rugby players or young football players. Okay, just put yourself in a scenario. We were just talking to someone the other day on my own series of interviews. Somebody enters one of those big football clubs in the UK or something like that and suddenly signs a contract for 30 grand or 40 grand a week or whatever that's like. Brilliant. Life is great. You know, goes out and buys a Ferrari and a new house and, you know, the beautiful looking partner. Life is great. Suddenly he gets injured or suddenly gets dropped out of contract. Man, it's like redundancy on steroids. You know, suddenly you're going to plunge into a situation of what defined him. His purpose is gone. What defined him is gone. The adoration from the fans is all gone. You know, maybe somebody leaves him. Maybe he can't get another job. Talk about entering into an area of mental health difficulties and, you know, and then multiply that in the likes of the States where these young athletes go into the American football or American basketball and they have what everybody else seems to be a dream life. You know, half of them are broke at 40 and they don't know what to do. So that's a real cauldron of mental health difficulties. But yet, again, here's the kicker. Coaches and managers place less importance on the holistic view of a person's mental health than they do on the physical view. And that needs to change. Because if I was a coach tomorrow, the most successful coaches I've ever met look after their players, both physically and mentally. So they build up a rapport, they build up a communication network with their players to say, hey, you can come to me with anything that's going on outside of the game, and I'll try to understand, but I've been there for you, I care about you as a person, I'm there to support you. They are the coaches that have the greatest impact on players' lives. You know, regardless of wins, regardless of cups, regardless of championships. So my message to any aspiring rugby coach or football coach or GAA coach is look after your players first. And that involves looking after their mental health as well as their physical health.
That's a great point, Brad. Actually, I'm sure you'll agree, it should happen from all the way from schools level right up to, yeah, you know, being a professional athlete.
Absolutely, because if we take a holistic view, it's as simple as this, Owen, and it's something I never get. How can you ask a worker, if you're in listening from business or you're listening from sport, a worker or a player, whoever you're involved with, to perform at optimal level if their mental health, if their mind is somewhere else? Relationship with their parents, relationship with their girlfriend or their boyfriend or their partner, relationship with their kids. What's happening outside of the sphere of the arena or the pitch or whatever it is, or work, what's happening outside of them that you can bring some positivity to and say, okay, we're looking after that side of it. All we want you to do is to be come to the match or whatever, or come into work and be clear of mind, and we're all focused on the same direction because we care about you. You know, it's something as simple as that, but largely it doesn't happen. You know, and people ask me all the time from a business point of view, how do I get the best out of my employees? The best way to get that out of them is show that you care about them. or be vulnerable with them. Say, I'm not the perfect boss or I'm not the perfect coach, but I care about you guys as a group, you know, and we're all focused in the same way. We all want the same thing. We all want to be successful. But, you know, care about people.
Is this something, Brent, that you didn't see as a rugby player, you know, growing up and obviously migrating into a professional?
No, because I didn't have, whether people call it courage or whatever. I thought it would be less of a man if I went to my teammates or my coaches and said, hey, I'm struggling with this. I'm not struggling with the physical side of it. You know, I was one of the fittest rugby players in New Zealand as I saw it. Gym every day, that lifestyle, that everybody else looking into my lifestyle would have said, you know, Brent's in a great place. You know, good job, university educated, you know, fit at sport, good at sport, playing rugby for his country, doing all these things. But it just wasn't enough for me. So I couldn't go to anybody, and that was the problem. That's why I set up the elephant in the room at the end. We'll talk about it in a few minutes. That's why I set it up, because I don't want anybody else to go through what I have. And people might say, oh, well, you know, just get on with it. Man up, toughen up, harden up, push through, all these things I was told. I just couldn't do it without help. And I was too scared to get help, because what did help look like for me in that generation? It looked like showing I was weak. You know, I was a wimp of a man, less of a man. Less of a man because I turned around to a teammate and said, hey, mate, something's going on, you know, with my private life that I'm struggling with, and it's overflowing onto my performance on the field. Just felt weak. Felt that I couldn't share that with somebody. Felt I couldn't even share it with my own father. You know, and I mean, he said it's such a loving thing to me in his 80s when he read my book, because he had the book in the back.
Yeah.
thanks for that. But he put his hand on my shoulder one time and kind of tears at that age and said, hey, I wish I'd have known, son. And I said, I wish I'd been able to tell you, Dad, you know, because it would have stopped me going down plenty of rabbit holes in my life if I had just had somebody to talk to and not feel so alone and not feel so abnormal. I thought I was the only kid going through this, the only kid that had to hide what I was going through around the anxiety and depression and, you know, breakdown, if you want to use that term later. I thought I was the only one going through that because I couldn't find anybody else that would say, hey, Brent, you know, you're not the only one going through this, you know, and it's not so abnormal. I just felt different. I felt ostracized. I felt that I couldn't talk to anybody, and I felt alone, and I felt shame, and I felt guilt, and all these things. Why do you feel shame? You feel shame because you can't fix yourself. I could fix my body. I could go after a doctor with any sporting injury, and I've had a lot of, man, I've probably broken every bone in my body at some stage, apart from the really serious ones. But I could go to the doctor, and I had a high pain threshold, and I would go along and say, put me in a cast. And, you know, a couple of weeks before the cast, then I'd rip the cast off, and I'd go back playing rugby, and I'd break things again. That was easy. My God, trying to find someone that could help my mental side of things, that was hard.
And on that, Brent, like, how did that come about? Did you reach out to someone, or was there a certain point in your life where you just said, you know, you shared it with someone?
There's always a point in somebody's life when they're ready to share it, you know, and that's what I do now, because I said, let's not let brothers or sisters or aunties or uncles slip through the net here, because it's a situation in my world, and I'll keep this cliche as long as I live, that in my world, it's not for everybody, I know, but in my world, a problem shared is so often a problem half. If you can just talk to somebody else and they can just listen, you know, if they can just be there to listen, don't be there, you know, here's the first nugget. Don't be there to tell them what works for you. You know, I got sick of people saying to me, oh, Brent, you know, what I do is this, 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 and this. If somebody's out there suffering from depression, they'll know what I mean. The last thing you can think of is when you're suffering from depression is getting up and going to the goddamn gym. That's the last thing you can think about. It's an effort just to get out of bed. It's an effort to go and have a shave. It's an effort to have a wash if you're feeling that way. So I don't tell anybody what to do. What I'll maybe say is this might help. But the first thing that helps the most is sharing it with somebody else, and for somebody else to say, hey, I care about you, Owen. You know, we want the old Owen back at work. We want the old Owen back in the rugby team or the GAA team or something. How can I help? How can I help? And sometimes, for a lot of people, as they said, look, I just appreciate you being there. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to feel guilt around saying to somebody, oh, just be strong. That, you know, that added Irish thing, oh, you're strong, you're strong. God damn it, some people aren't strong. Some people going through bereavement or grief and that, they should be allowed to grieve. And it's okay to say, hey, yeah, anybody would be going through those feelings. If anybody's lost a marriage or lost all their financial things or lost a job or lost a partner or lost anybody like that, everybody goes through a grieving process. But yet we're told, you know, be strong, bounce back, you know, you'll be back. You know, some people find that harder than other people to do that. And that's when they need to talk to somebody. And if it's somebody, if it's a friend or if it's a colleague, have someone in your life that you can talk to. It doesn't have to be your own family, doesn't have to be a sibling, doesn't have to be a therapist, but someone, find someone, because you need to find someone in that time, an hour of need. Now, I found that because I do the work for the Samaritan, I found it in a simple conversation with the lowest point in my life was the Samaritans. And you know what? That part of the conversation will stay with me forever. And I made that call I'm not going to tell you what led up to that, but I made that call in kind of desperation. I saw a faint light that wanted to keep me going, put it that way, that I had something to live for, I had something to go on, you know, and achieve. And so the conversation, when I rang them, I didn't expect to get an answer at that time. I didn't. And then this wonderful man's voice and the tone of it, whatever like that, just come on and said, it'll be okay, friend. Just that. Wow. That part of the sentence, it will be okay, friend. Somebody called me a friend that I didn't know. And I mean, I look back later in life and I said, how powerful was that part of the conversation? A, somebody giving me hope that things would be okay. And B, somebody showing that they cared by calling me a friend. So I say to people out there, that smile that you have, that quick chat to your elderly neighbor, that hello down at the supermarket, that in itself can change people's lives. Random acts of kindness can change people's lives, because you don't know what's going on in their life at that split second. You don't know what they're going through at home, abroad, whatever. You don't know. But just a smile and a handshake and a compliment or something to say, you know, that same thing, you'll be okay, friend. We'll get through this together. That's all I'm trying to do. That's all I'm trying to do. I'm not there telling companies or football teams or GA teams or rugby teams what their strategy should be, you know, because that's forever changing. But what I am saying to everybody out there that's listening is just let's care about people a bit more. You know, I'm not asking people to do everything every day for charities and everything. No, that's not reality. But what I am asking people to do is to take into consideration that you don't know how somebody is feeling on any given day. And rather than kind of greet them that way and you know, just, you know, greet them in a kind, you know, welcoming, non-judgmental manner.
Yeah. And actually, I experienced that myself in my own neighbors here when COVID hit. And yeah. There was one positive that came out of COVID is that I know absolutely every neighbor on this street.
Absolutely.
But in a kind, nice way. And, you know, we used to get groceries for our next door neighbor who's 86. Yeah. He lives by himself. And I think, you know, he appreciates when I meet him and we have a chat in the morning. And when you were talking about that there, it kind of sparked that memory. But with that, Brent, it takes a lot of courage. Obviously, what you did there, you picked up the phone, you talked to the Samaritans.
Yeah.
What would you say to someone that's listening now that hasn't made that call yet? You know, because it does take a lot of courage to do something like that.
Yeah, and it's often a word kind of used in a sense. People come back and say, oh, that was courage. I don't see it as being courage. What I want to try to create out there, the most important thing for me is it should just be more part of the norm You know, people shouldn't have to be seen as brave or courageous because they shared a story. You know, if you shared a story with me tomorrow and about, look, I'm, you know, I'm going through tough times, Brent, and, you know, I would just say, hey, you know, that's more normal than you think. I wouldn't necessarily see you as being brave and courageous. I think that's a tag that's often used on people that maybe put things up on the more sort of visible platform, which I've done. But I didn't see it that way. For me, the important thing was that, and I still find it difficult, I'd have to say, and I still find it difficult when I'm out there talking, because my first instinct as somebody that suffered from depression and anxiety, the first instinct of our kind of people, when I call them our kind of people, is that you go to the one bad comment out of 99 and think that is the real comment. 99% of the people can say, you're courageous, Brent, what a wonderful thing you're doing. If one person turns around and says, oh, I don't, you know, whatever like that, that is what people like us focus on, unfortunately. And you've got to do a lot of work around that. I have to do a lot of work around the judgment, because that's the generation I grew up in, being judged. So you look at the Facebook generation, people are getting judged every day. You know, the way they look, you know, their lifestyles, how they act, how they should act, or whatever like that. That judgment is piling on young people tenfold. You know, bullying, social media bullying, comments made about the way people's waiters, the way they look, and say, judgment everywhere now. You know, but, and that took a long time, really, for me to be able to say, hey, I'm doing something good here, and leave it at that, and not go away and feel that saying, because now I turn that around and say, if I can appeal to the one person that is struggling or is suffering and takes my advice and goes and talks to someone or calls the Samaritans or Pieta House or where, whatever like that, that is the first step. That is the first step to people's eventual recovery. And I'm telling people out there now, if you're in a low place or you're watching this and you're feeling depressed or anxious and that, there is a full chance of recovery. Full chance of recovery, that you'll get your life back in days, weeks, months, however long it takes, but you've got to make that first step and talk to somebody about it. And that's where it starts. People that have addiction problems, they know that. They know they've got to go into rehab. They know they've got to stop smoking or drinking. They know that. People around mental health get into such a state, they think there's no help out there. And then what's the alternative? And sadly, the alternative for nearly 500 people next year in Ireland, the alternative we don't want to think about. I've lost too many people in my life, Owen, friends, colleagues that have taken their own lives, and I just scream out, why, you know, how did it get to be that situation? And I always remember that Adam Clayton is one of our ambassadors to the Elephant Room and a fabulous guy, but I used a song, the U2 song, Stuck in the Moment and Can't Get Out of It, because that is how we feel. No matter how that long that moment is, it could be a minute, it could be a week, it could be a month, it could be a year, it could be 10 years. If you get stuck in that moment and feel you can't get out of it, that's what I'm trying to avoid people. Let's not let people get into that moment in the first place.
And that starts. It's just about having that one conversation.
Yeah, that one conversation that changed my life and could change someone else's life. You don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know that chat on the bus to somebody that was feeling lonely that day, you don't know if that gives them enough spur to say, okay, I've got something to live for. Somebody cares about me. You know, because there's a very good, if people think there's a very good guy, I won't give you the backstory. Kevin Myers, if anybody wants to continue on that, is a story of a young guy that kissed his father goodbye, I think 19 or 20 years of age or something, and walked to the Golden Gate Bridge or whatever. And he says in his talk, I told myself the greatest lie I'd ever told, that no one cares. So it was the greatest lie that he told himself, that no one cares. There's always someone out there that cares. You've just got to find that person and you've got to contact them and say, hey, I'm going through troubled waters. And 9 times out of 10, he will say, hey, I've been there too. You know, and let's go and let's get care together and get help together. That's the first process. So, as I said, that's in a sense why I created the elephant in the room, because I was saying to you, oh, yeah, everybody has an elephant. Everybody listening, the three people that are listening to me. No, we all are elephants. And what do I mean by an elephant? I mean that if I say to somebody, if I ask them a question and they say to me, it's the elephant in the room, Brent, that suddenly signifies to me it's something awkward, it's something that's scarring, it's somewhere they don't want to go just yet. What I'm saying to people is we all have our elephants, whether it's sexuality, whether it's gender, whether it's work-related, whatever it is that's eating you up inside. Isn't it better to get that out and share that with somebody than let it fester away for years or months or years? I get people coming back to me, Owen, when I was doing a bit of therapy work years ago, that were still grieving, you know, the loss of their mother or something, you know, daily for 15 years. They had never addressed it. And other areas in their life, they hadn't addressed for 10, 15, 20, 25 years. I had a woman come up to me the other day about something. She said, Brent, she was in tears, and she said, I just saw your wonderful elephants. And she said, I realize I have to go home and have a discussion with my husband over something that she had hidden so deep for so many years. And she came back to me and she said, just had the most wonderful conversation in sharing something that had been bugging me for so many years that I'd held in a kind of a dark place, and that's what it's about.
How did you feel when she said that to you, Brent?
It's a really good question. And this is not an ego thing. When people come up to me, I feel the same way. There's something. I feel the same way that I feel about that man that talked to me. You know, I would have loved him to have met that voice at some stage in my life. I would have loved to have gone back. Sorry, it's making me emotionally. I'd have loved to have gone back and said to that guy, hey, and it's what I say to all the Samaritans volunteers now. These people are saving lives every conversation. You know, and they need to be told. And you made a good point about COVID. The good things about COVID, and people say, oh, there was nothing good about COVID. Yes, there was. And the good thing was recognition for the likes of nurses and frontline workers was suddenly felt justified for what they're doing, and rightly so. They were saving lives, and they suddenly got the appreciation. And then we moved back into a world where they're suddenly not appreciated. People called into elderly neighbours. People were kinder. You know, if there was a death on the road, we all went out onto the streets to show our respect. Those were the wonderful sides of COVID. And then suddenly we come out of COVID and went back to our busy lives, you know, materialistic lives, if you want to call it that, it's the connections you make in your life that are the most important one. It's the connections. If you ask somebody at 20 what will make them happy or what will deem to be successful, it's two things the answer they'll give you, money and fame. If you ask them at 50 or 60 what's meant the most in their lives, friends, family, giving back. So I say to people, find your purpose. Maybe it's taken me 60 odd years to find my purpose, you know, but my purpose now is to educate people around care, you know, and just to say, and if they want to turn off and say, look, you know, I'm not that type of person, then that's them. But I'm just appealing to the majority of people that actually would like to care for community, like to care for their family, like to care for things like that, you know, they would.
Yeah, absolutely, Brent. I totally agree with you. You mentioned elephant in the room there. For our audience, Brent, what is elephant in the room?
I'm passionate about a couple of things, you know, well, a few. Rugby, obviously, is a sport that allowed me to come to Ireland and have a life around media and stuff like that. I also loved art, and I'm also passionate, obviously, about mental health advocacy. So a few years ago, I tried to combine the art and the kind of, because creativity is good for mental health. Music, you know, what you do, the media, you know, acting, painting, making music, all these things are good for your mental health. We know that. And I felt good. I had a gallery for a couple of years where I promoted what I call outsider art or brute art, which was art coming from the mental health organizations or from the prisons or from the homeless and that, because it was art uncooked by culture, as I call it. It was people were doing the art for the right reasons, whether that was rehab art, whether that was art to make them feel better. So a few years ago, I saw these cats down in Kilkenny in a hotel, these wonderfully decorated painted cats. And I was talking to the manager down there. I said, oh, these are great. Not just as, and he said, I think they were a fundraiser in those days for Kilkenny tourists or the Kilkenny cats or whatever, you know. And I thought, what can I do that really gets to the kind of the root of the problem as I saw it? What can I do to get people starting a conversation around mental health? And I looked at all these different animals and I looked at all these different sculptures, you know, that you see in the doctor's office, the half brain, half. I think, no, that doesn't work. And then I was talking to an Eastern European man about mental health who came up to me after I talked in the construction industry. And he came up to me and he said, Brent, he said, I just feel, you know, weak talking about to colleagues about my mental health around anxiety and that. And he said, you know, and this big, strong, heavily tattooed man was nearly breaking down in tears and saying, I you know, and he said, it's my elephant in the room. And it was a eureka moment for me. And right. I thought, that's his elephant. Somebody else's elephant could be addiction. Somebody else's elephant could be homophobia. Somebody's elephant could be like that. And I just then thought, it also ties into the fact that when we talk about the elephant in the room, we're actually talking about something we don't want to talk about. So I combined the two together. And I got hold of a couple of colleagues who worked in that area logistically, in the sense of where we could get the sculptures done, where we could get them shipped in from. They had all the artists, so we combined forces, and the elephant in the room was conceived. But man, I couldn't for a minute have thought about where it's gone now. You know, every day we've got people coming on and saying, look, we love it because it's simple and it's a message, and companies or sporting organizations or celebrities or whatever, anybody can have an elephant there. They're 5 foot high, they're beautifully decorated, they're works of art for a start. But the message out there, it comes on a plinth, and the message is out there is, you know, we need to, you know, while you're working or while you're employed here or while you're at this sporting organization, let's make talking about mental health a priority and a normal part of conversation, or words to that effect. We move them around. And in fact, just, I know I talk a lot, but when we had the official launch about, the year and a half ago, we had how I knew it was going to work was because we had a couple of photos taken with the real elephant out in the zoo. So we had our elephants in the four picture, and we had the real elephants out the back. And there was an American woman showing her, I think, I don't know how old the young guy was, a young son was, I'd say 7 or 8 or whatever, might have been younger. But he rushed over because he just loved the sight of the elephant something. He rushed over and he started patting the elephant and that, and said, and he looked at the plinth, and his mother came over and she had a chair with a younger child. And she said, what's all this about or something? He looked and he said, it's about talking about stuff, mum. Like, what the responsibility. I thought, then I knew it was going to work, because I thought, if somebody that young gets it and the message, and he just said, mum, well, it's about talking about things, mum. And he kind of pointed a finger as if to say, we don't talk about stuff at that age. I thought that was wonderful. We have a charity partner, which is, you know, the Samaritans, obviously, for me. And then we also have a social justice, fund that allows us to get elephants out to schools. We've had some donated into children's hospitals, into hospitals, rehab centers. So people are really getting on board. We have companies every day saying, look, you know, can we put one out? We've just got a company on there somewhere. Can we put one out to Trinity and UCD and all and UCC and all that? Because they can sit outside. We work with the companies as far as getting an artist involved or branding it up, whatever way they want. And they just adopt an elephant and it's a start. I'm not telling them what they should do, run strategies or policies and all that. I'm just saying, let this be the starting point to have a conversation. So the first day you arrive and work and you see one of these elephants, you know you're in a place of care, that somebody up the chain has thought about you. My God, would I have loved to have seen an elephant when I was going in and playing rugby. If I'd seen an elephant, that would have given me a little bit of hope and permission to say, it's okay. It's okay to talk about it.
And you know, okay. Brent, like I'm just thinking of a candidate maybe sitting in a reception waiting to go in for an interview, right? And having an elephant in the reception area. I mean, how good are you kind of showing off your company culture and what it's like to work here? So for any company out there, to create a better candidate experience, get an elephant in the reception.
Absolutely, because it also gives the people the confidence that going in there, half of going into interviews is believing in yourself, and you're believing that you're in a place of non-judgment. You know, yes, you can make mistakes and stuff like that. I mean, a lot of stress comes around for people going into anxiety, but I my advice to them is make stress your friend. And people look at me and say, what's that about? And I say, it's about looking at a stressful situation and saying it's your body's way of preparing you for the challenge. You know, your veins open up, adrenaline flows through your body. Use that. Don't play it against yourself. Use that to your advantage and say, okay, I'm ready for this challenge. You can only control the controllables. So when you go into an interview, ask yourself a couple of questions. A, ask how you can help, because that's the most important thing, how you can help that company or that interview. You know, and that maybe saying is, okay, I can bring all this to you, because that's what they want to hear. They want to, they don't want to hear how they help you. They want to hear how you can help them. That's where you're going for the job. And also the most important thing in that situation to dampen down the anxiety, look at the worst case scenario and say, okay, if the worst case thing is I don't get this particular job, might I take the learnings out of this interview? Might I get a better job? Might I get a better opportunity? Absolutely yes is the answer. You might, you know, just because you miss out on the job. See, the angst is all about, I really need this job or something, and if I don't get this job, all is lost or whatever. And people get anxious about it. And so rather than going and say, okay, this is a learning experience, whether I get the job or not, you know, take the learnings out and say, if it's the worst case scenario and they call me back the next day and say you were in the last three or something, but you didn't get the job, unfortunately, say, okay, well, the positives out of that, I got into the last three, and now I'm going to take that learnings to my next interview and say, okay, you know, that's the way I've looked at my life and certain things. I just said, look, if I can get over this hump, then I can get over anything, you know.
Exactly. It's about getting that constructive feedback, isn't it? And if you flip that there, which is brilliant, it's actually when you don't get the job, but you get the constructive feedback, that's a step towards your actual job that you're going to get.
Yeah, and you know, believe in yourself and go in there and say, not everybody wants the correct answer. As you know, as an interviewer, you've talked to a lot of people over times, you know, about this. Not everybody wants the correct molded answer. Be yourself. You know, what are your strong points? Okay, look at your weak points and move away from them. But give something of yourself. Give something of your personality. And if you have to change your answers, just slow down and take a breath and say, okay, no, you know, that's, you know, I need to think about this again, because all these things show you your personality, your ability to think on your feet, your ability to change. Don't just give somebody stock answers that you've got off the internet that want to hear, you know, what are your weaknesses? Oh, you know, I work too hard. We've heard it all before. No, you can just say, look, I'd rather concentrate on my strengths or what I can bring to you. But at the end of the day, what they want to hear in any business is what they want to hear at the end of the day, same as when you're doing a resume. They want to actually know what you can bring to them, not the other way around. So many other people say, oh, you know, they were telling me this and that. And I said, no, it's just a matter of saying, I can bring this. I might not be so proficient at this and that, but I'll learn and I can move like that. That's what they want to hear, you know, at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's about the company asking why you and why now.
Yeah, exactly.
And why your experience.
That's it.
Brent, what's your advice for someone who does get very anxious about finding a job and maybe the whole process is very overwhelming? They've had a lot of no's and, you know, it is actually affecting their mental health.
Absolutely.
What would you advise to someone like that listening at the moment?
Because it defines you. Because if somebody is going through redundancy or anything like that, it's nothing to do with, I say to them, it's not a personal thing. It's not a personal thing. So take that out of it for a start, because I just spoke to a group down there who were going through a company restructuring about a month ago. And I said, look, this is not personal. You've done a great job for this company, whatever. It's nothing to do with that. They're restructuring and that shutting down. Nothing to do with you. So also look at the fact that it doesn't define you. you know, certain vocations define you more than others, as we know, teaching, nurses or whatever, they define you because there's a certain type of person that is drawn to that workspace. But for most people, it doesn't define you. So what I suggest to people that are like that, try to find you, while you're going through that process of redundancy, try to find a different purpose. You know, try to find a purpose, whether it's doing some charity work, whether it's, you know, getting yourself fit or something like that. Try to find that purpose so that you're not so defined by, you know, so much pressure on getting the job, getting the next job or something like that. And then the other bit of advice that I've been trying to say, talk to someone. Go and see someone. Talk to some professional and say, what more do I need to do to control the controllables? Because talking to someone is about controlling what you can control. It's getting the advice from them. You know, the next interview, I've messed up on the last few. What do I do about it? Just don't go down the same stuck in the moment thing. Like, you know, change the outlook to change the inlook, you know, in a sense. You know, but and you may need help. You may need to come to you, Owen. You know, yeah, talk to absolutely. People like the professional people. It's an investment in your future. But don't get caught up in it. It doesn't define you. No work should define you. What should define you is the connections you make with people, the kindness you show. That's what you should define. So once you take that off the table, say, look, okay, this is what I can offer to this company. I'm good at my job. I was good at my job for 25 years before I was redundant, and I'll be good again. Mm-hmm. Just build your confidence up and appreciate your little achievements each day. There's certain things I go through, and with not enough time now, I nickname it space, which is control the stress, make stress your friend if it's acute. If it's chronic, plan around the stress. You know, give yourself some days to just say, look, I'll give you an hour at 6 o'clock or whatever to deal with the stress. Come at me with everything. Take stuff out of your head. Put it down in the journal. Practice mindfulness, meditation, these techniques, you know, nature, all these things, you know, achievements, connections, enjoy, find something you enjoy every day. All these things can put into the same pot.
Yeah, have you heard of the 333 rule?
No.
So it's when anxiety hits. So when anxiety triggers, you look around to identify three objects.
Yeah, I
don't think this was made for Irish people, 333, but look around to identify three objects, three sounds, and move three parts of your body. And I use that.
Yeah. Yeah,
if I get an anxiety attack or a panic attack, yeah. And it works really well.
No, that's good advice. I'm panic attacks. You know, I've suffered them for them too since an early age.
Hmm.
But it's really about coming down from that kind of attack phase. So what I used to do, because I used to call it my Gatling gun in the book, all these negative thoughts, you know, this is going to happen. You'll be a failure, Brent. You'll be a loser. You'll never succeed. Bang, bang, bang. All coming in at one time. You're there. Little part of you is on the other side of the elephant, you know, like on a rope saying, no, please God, don't let this happen. This is not the real me. But what I do to try to trick my brain in that situation, I just said, look, I will give you all you've got to give me between 5 and 6 o'clock, and I'll bring my notebook down and I'll, you know, come at me with everything you got, you know, and I'll give that 1 hour, I'll give it all the time, just come to me with all the doubts, all these things, all the failures and all that. Then after the hour, I'll just say, now leave me alone. I'm kind of, I trick my brain into saying, okay, you've got your piece now, you've got your piece of me for that hour. And it works. Actually, for me, it works.
Brilliant.
Because other than that, stressed at night, not being able to get to sleep, all these thoughts coming in, you know, you won't get this job, you'll fail, you're all this. And at some stage, you just want to say, leave me alone. Leave your own brain alone. Will you just give me some peace for a bit? So I said, okay, forget about me till tomorrow at 5 o'clock, and then come up with everything you got. And I should have challenged myself. Come on, give me it all, you know. And then I write down what needs to happen for this to happen. So I say, look, okay, that's not a reality. You know, that's not a reality. And it's just my mind playing tricks on me. And once I go through my journaling and say, look, okay, this doesn't need to happen, Brent. This doesn't need to happen. It's not a reality. And I go through those things and I say all the things that, if this is the worst thing that can happen, can I manage that? And the answer usually, 99% of the time, okay, there's 1% of the time that it's a different thing, you know, people dealing with terminal diagnosis and that, you know. But even then, it's been proven that if you have a positive outlook, you know, it's far better than having a negative one. But even then, I just say, you know, what's the worst that can happen? And most people will look at that and say, yeah, I've been through worse, or I got through that before, and they'll get through it again.
Yeah, when I'm anxious, I don't do this all the time. I should probably do it more, but I write everything down I'm anxious about, yep. And then I rip it up and throw it in the bin. And actually, it feels so nice afterwards. It's a very simple thing to do, but
that works so effectively. That also played into the elephant, Owen. Take it
exactly.
out of your head.
Yes, yeah. Brent, while I have you, I couldn't kind of let the interview go without your friends George and Tom, right? and there's a great interview. There's a great interview I remember on The Late Late with you, George, George Hook, and Tom McGurk, where Ryan asked you about being pals, and I think he calls you the Three Amigos at one point. It's a great interview for any of the audience listening. Yeah. You can get on YouTube. But I have to ask, what was it like with George and Tom on the rugby analysis during that period? Because it looked like you had unbelievably natural chemistry between the three of you.
Yeah. I loved it. I loved it. You know, people often said, you know, I mean, George used to play. When I'm friends, I wouldn't go to McGurk's place if he was, you know, if he was on fire, I wouldn't, you know. But you know. I love George, and I love working with him. I love working with Tom and that. And while we weren't in each other's pockets, and while we were different ages and different views, we respected what the other person brought to it. You know, George was the, you know, I know it was good cop and bad cop, but that's generally the type of person I am. I, you know, when I'm talking about rugby, I was generally more, despite not being particularly positive at times with my own life, when I talk about other people's sporting achievements, or whether it's Brian O'Driscoll or Paul O'Connell or the Irish team or something, I was always overly positive because that's the way that I tried to address my own life. I thought, what's the point of thinking negatively here? Even though it's hard sometimes not to think that way, I learned pretty early on that, you know, the way forward for me, tiptoeing forward at times, was there could be another outcome here. But it was great fun. You know, we were characters, and now it seems to have morphed into a more sort of sedate commentary. Like George would be, every second week he'd be coming out with these pearls, you know, like, you know, O'Driscoll is too slow. I remember saying at halftime, you know, Tommy Bow has lost his pace, you know, he's gone, you know, and then Tommy scored a 60-metre try. Looked at him at George great times, you know. Like, you know, come up with all these sayings, I can't remember now, you know, that would just crack you up, you know, like, you know, somebody has the larder and England have the Ferrari or something. You know, like, but I miss him, you know. You know, I know he's getting on, and he was 80 a couple of years ago, as was Tom, but I miss the camaraderie, and I loved going in and doing those commentaries, and they were fun, you know, like people would always switch over at halftime and watch the commentaries. You know, we had letters coming in from 80-year-old grandmothers saying, you know, stop short of throwing the jam jar at the screen when George was on. Like, you know, he was a sort of a pantomime villain in a lot of ways. But no, I loved it. And it was and remain a huge part of my life and a huge part of my Irish life. I love when people come up to you in the street and say, oh, you know, Popey, we used to turn the TV on every week. You know, people of all ages, and I miss that a bit. You know,
I remember back then the talking point in the pub afterwards was,
yeah,
you know, the laugh that you guys had between each other rather than the game.
Yeah. You don't get that so much anymore. There's not so much social interaction, or there's not so much entertainment value. You know, and I mean, most of the people. You know, most of the people that watch a rugby match, if you've got a million viewers, 80% of them actually don't want to know that A should have passed the ball to B and should have passed the ball to C, and they don't want to know that. They want to know the questions, like, you know, should the coach be sacked after this loss? You know, should somebody be dropped for next week? So that's the kind of talk that we used to have, and George, in that sense, was the one percenter. in the sense he would be calling out what the person on the bar stool would be saying, you know, like, you know, so-and-so is useless, had a useless game. When everybody else was scared to say it, George, like Eamon Dunphy and these types of Joe Broly, and they would say it. Pat Spillane, all these people would say it. They'd say, look, you know, that's how they felt. So I miss that. I know things had to change, you know, things had to become more PC, and there was, you know, had to be less criticism, and you know, but still, it's still entertainment. You know.
It was brilliant. I absolutely loved it. I regularly go back and watch them back.
George won't be listening in.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Brent, I think what you're doing is great. Using your platform to help and support men and women that could be going through the toughest time in their lives.
Thanks,
so. Find a light. You need to be commended for it. And the world needs more people like you. Mr. Brent Pope, thank you so much.
Thanks very much. Delighted. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Interview Expert. Make sure to check out our website, yourhire.ie, where you can subscribe to the show and also find out more interview tips and tricks. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. Owen Murray is available for private coaching. See our website for details at yourhire.ie. Until next time, do good, feel good, and be good.